Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Radio Z Hour, an interactive talk show celebrating the written word. Presented by the Zahme Publishing Press, www.zahme.com. That's ZHARMAE.com.
Hey, and welcome to the written word, the Radio Z talk show hour up on Blog Talk Radio. How's everybody doing tonight? This is your host, Tom Julian, and tonight I'm going to be joined by Zahme authors, Tempest Saunders, as well as our good friend, Joshua Dunn. Looking forward to talking to those guys, and tonight we're going to be talking about story arcs. Most specifically, we're going to be talking about reaching a climax. But before we get to that, and before we start talking to our fantastic authors, a little housekeeping to get out of the way. You can like us on Facebook at fb.com/tzppradioz. And you can check out the first chapters of all your favorite Zahme books by visiting firstreadsfirst.com. That's first, reads with a Z, first.com. And what you'll get when you visit that is striking covers in the first two or three chapters of all your favorite Zahme books. No clutter and ads if we can avoid it, and links for purchase. And most Zahme books are available on Kindle for under $5. Excellent. So tonight we are talking about going to climax, reaching climax in a book, and the storytelling structures and techniques that authors use to bring their audiences through to a satisfying conclusion in a book. It's a little bit more than just reaching a climax. I think the concept of story arcs is really important, and we'll be talking about that tonight. And I believe we have our good friend Tempest on the line. Tempest, are you there?
I'm here.
Hey, what's going down, girlfriend?
How you doing?
I'm good. I'm really good. I'm hanging in there. What's happening in your neck of the woods this evening?
Tonight was about comic books and video games.
Tonight was about comic books and video games. What games were you playing?
I was playing Immortals. It's a WWE app on the tablets.
Yeah? Cool. Who were you playing as?
The team I was playing with before I called you was The Undertaker, Seth Rollins, and Stone Cold Steve Austin.
Nice. That's awesome. That is awesome. I was playing on the tablet right before this. I was playing World of Tanks Blitz, which is a tank combat 7-on-7 game. Me and my little boy play that together sometimes, and he has a little speech impediment, so he says platoons instead of platoons, and it's really cute. He goes, Daddy, let's play platoons, and we go and play platoons.
That is cute.
So that, yeah, it is really cute. I live with a child who's just possibly the cutest little being on earth. He's like a tiny little guy. It's our youngest, and our daughter, her and I raked leaves today and then went to her soccer game. So I was like super dad all day long. But now I'm no longer super dad. I am dude talking about books. Talking about books. So we're talking about climaxes in books and what the journey is like for the reader going through a book and reaching a satisfying conclusion. Now, there are different interpretations of what, in storytelling, what a climax is. If you're analyzing, Shakespearean literature and looking at I think it's the Friedkin model, their climax is not necessarily when the Death Star explodes. That's the resolution. But the climax would be the moment in the story when the protagonist is ultimately tested to his limits and has to make a choice of whether to continue on his journey or not. So going with the Star Wars metaphor, the protagonist would have been Luke Skywalker, and his choice of whether to continue on his journey would have been when Obi-Wan was cut down. And that is what I believe is the climax, an example of a climax of a story. But other, you know, in other interpretations, the climax of the story is, you know, the end when the hero gets the girl, or when they, you know, they sink the enemy battleship, or, you know, or the vampire gets killed or something like that. So it's sort of, you know, it's up to interpretation. But hey, so your stories have, or the stories in your books have plenty of arcs. I know you've written a series. What was the series you've written?
It's called the Mystic Academy series.
Yeah.
And the first book has been released. It's called Awakened.
Yeah. And your story arc in the first book, Awakens, can you tell us about the story arc and what the character, your main character, experienced during that story arc?
Well, the story arc in the first book is Rora, the main character, is a normal girl living in Long Island. It's summer vacation, and she comes home to find an acceptance letter to a school she never applied to, and she just feels the urge as she's looking through the catalog and seeing pictures of the school, like, I kind of belong there. So she kind of sets out on this kind of quest to convince her parents, you know, I want to try the school. So she ultimately does convince her parents. They make a deal. You know, she can try the school for a year. If there are no major problems, she can stay. But
So what does she have a point in the book when she has to decide whether to continue or come home or give up? Or she's
she does have a point where she needs to continue or give up. It's not so much about coming home. It's about whether or not to continue in the battle. There is a point where a battle breaks out in the school, and she's not actually at the school. But that's
okay.
The first of her choices. The choice does she go back? Because she knows that the people are looking for her. They're tearing apart the school.
Right.
They're terrorizing the school. And she knows they're looking for her. So her first choice is, do I stay safe where I am, or do I go back to the school and help the people at the school, the people who are teaching me so much about these new abilities that I'm coming into?
Oh, I get it. So that's her moment of decision. That's her moment of choice, in a sense. That's where she makes the call of whether she wants to answer the call of being a hero or not.
That's the first one. The second one is she suffered a tragedy, and she thinks that she doesn't have anything left in her to give, and it would be easy to just give up. And it's a question of, is she ready to dig down deeper to find that strength and continue on to really, really, you know, be the person that her friends and everyone that cares about her need her to be.
Oh, that's very, that's a couple, so she has a couple different arcs, and she's kind of finding a way through the hero's journey. I believe we have on the line with us, joining us is Joshua Dunn, another Zarmé author who is here to talk to us about his story and about his take on our topic tonight. Joshua Dunn is the author of the Exile Empire series, and wanted to introduce Joshua. Joshua, are you there?
Yes, I am. How are you?
Hey, Joshua. How are you feeling tonight? What's going on? What's going down?
Pretty good. Well, you wanted to know my take on the idea of the climax. I think that crescendo is a better word. I've had a lot of musical experience, and I find that just like in music, where you have multiple crescendos throughout the piece leading up to the grand crescendo, the same you have in stories. And those can be little things like decisions that a character makes, emotional snapping points to the tipping point, right when the beat drops and you're about to enter that final conflict and the character has to decide to make that plunge. I think all of those are very important.
Like the bridge in a song, where the song kind of goes off the refrain and the melody for like a brief moment, and then continues back on.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Cool. So, challenge for you: name the crescendo from Indiana Jones, the original.
The first one?
Yeah, Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Raiders of the Lost Ark. Okay, I actually think, well, obviously there's a bunch in it, but I think the Raiders of the Lost Ark, well, first off, Indiana Jones is not a motivating character in that story. If you had removed Indiana Jones from Raiders of the Lost Ark, the story would have played out exactly the same. The Nazis would have still gotten the Ark to the island where they opened it. They would have still opened the Ark, and they would have still gotten their faces melted off. So I think
that's exactly right. So I guess we have to look at it like from Indiana Jones's perspective. So I guess Indiana Jones is truly actually a character study of a guy on the journey.
He's along for the ride. And so because of that, I think when he's with his father, and we find out that the girl is a Nazi, I think that's the emotional crescendo of the story, because everything else is dependent on that. The development between the father and son as characters, your realization that these bad guys really are actually bad guys, and everything else is just a fallout from there. He doesn't make any decisions throughout the rest of the story. Everything else is like Deus Ex Machina, like when his friend shows up with the camels, or you know, when he just tags along on the submarine, and when he tries to, you know, ambush them, that's all just superfluous. It never motivates anything from that point. And so I think that's really it's very early on, but a crescendo can happen at the beginning of a book. In The Exile Empire, the event that breaks the main character's mind is in the very beginning, right after the prologue and everything is set up, so that you understand how everything proceeds from the fact that this person is fundamentally broken. And so that's why I think there's multiple crescendos, because there's the point where he goes a little bit mad. There's the point where he realizes that he's actually in love with the female protagonist. There's the point at which you realize, okay, they're launching the final attack. Once they enter this battle, there's no going back. Either they win or they go extinct. It's that sort of thing. I mean, you have all these different points that are all crescendos, and none of which I would necessarily define as the climax.
Very interesting take. And you bring up one thing in your Indiana Jones analysis, which always bothered me. I believe that he's a mermaid, because there's no way he was able to get on that submarine.
There's no way to get up the side.
Yeah, Tempest, you know what we're talking about, right? When he like dives off the boat and swims over to the submarine, and everybody on the boat cheers for Indiana Jones, he's on a submarine, and then that submarine, I assume, behaves like a submarine and goes like 800 miles it needs to go. So either he was like hanging on to like that little post that sticks out of the water for like 3 days, or he is a mermaid. So, I mean, that's a crescendo as well.
Well here's the problem. It's a little more reasonable than you would expect. World War II submarines almost never submerged. They only submerged when they were about to attack a ship. But the real problem is, how did he survive without water? Because he'd be in beating sun, and you'd dehydrate within a day.
Yeah, that part has always bothered me, besides the fact that when he's holding the bazooka on the ark, a bug crawls into the bad guy's mouth. You ever notice that?
No, I didn't.
No, you'll always think about that during that scene. But a bug crawls into the guy that always like wears the white suit, the kind of fancy guy. But it's very,
right,
it's very,
I'm gonna
very
look
weird.
That up right now.
Okay,
I have to see this
he's
now.
Challenging me. I'm being challenged. But you know, the crescendo and the climax is part of the story and part of the hero's journey. You know, outlaid by Joshua, done just now for us. But you know, these things are kind of universal. I was looking back at like some of the old analysis of ancient myths, and you had like the hero going on the journey, you know, the call to adventure, the reluctance, the decision to whether he wants to continue on the journey or not, you know, and then finally going forth and completing his journey. So this idea of there being a climax within storytelling is ancient, and it comes back from the times of people telling stories around campfires in oral traditions, and then reaching back to the classic myths that we have up into and including the Indiana Jones and I'm a Mermaid. So
you're right. A
so
bug
yeah.
does go in his mouth. I just saw it. It went into his mouth.
It totally went into his mouth.
It
when
totally
saying,
went
Blow
into
up.
His mouth. It just crawled right in.
Yep. And he's like yelling like the most important thing in the movie, which is, you know, don't you want to see the, I don't know, whatever it is, Wrath of God or whatever the heck, and a bug crawls in his mouth. So.
Well, that's actually, that might be intentional, because many times in both apocryphal and extra-biblical and Levitical traditions, demonic stuff is always associated with insect corrosion and, permeation. And so that could have been a very subtle and intentional jab to point out that this guy is truly evil.
Huh. I got to look that one up. I'm thinking that they just didn't have CGI yet and would have taken that out. But.
No. I mean, you would have had to draw it on. But it's very subtle. So, because you can draw that sort of thing on the film.
Right. I guess they could have taken it. I mean, with Steven Spielberg, I guess he could have done that. Back in the day. So here we are talking about story arcs. And let's look at some other ones. So, Tempest, are you familiar with the old Star Trek movies at all?
Star Trek, not so much. Star Wars, a little bit more familiar.
Okay, I was going to challenge you with tell us the climax of Wrath of Khan, which is probably the most accessible of the older Star Trek movies, but.
Well, you could have picked a really hard one and ask her about the undiscovered country.
No, you've got
that
the wrong
That one never had
there.
A plot and never will.
Undiscovered country?
No.
Yeah.
You know what's funny is it's probably one of the best ones, though. It doesn't really have that much of a plot.
It doesn't. It is no plot.
Sorry,
it's a murder
got the
mystery.
Wrong sibling.
Gosh, sorry. Yeah, back in the day, I actually pitched story ideas to Deep Space Nine and Voyager about 20 years ago. So I've kind of
Did
been
Did they
off.
Ever use any?
So, there was a moment where, you know, I saw something very familiar on screen, and my, you know, very close friend to this day, like, you know, brings that up every once in a while, but they didn't officially buy anything, but. You know, they did have my ideas in-house, but there is going to be a new Star Trek series coming out, which is coming out in 2017. Pretty exciting, jazzy stuff.
This actually plays into it. I was just reading an article about, you know, possible concepts for that new series, and the one that somebody was pitching was the fact about saying that maybe it's while Kirk and everybody was in the Academy. And the question I brought up is, Star Trek has primarily relied on the concept of fiddling with other people's civilizations, you know, messing with their governments and stuff like that. Even though that's against the prime directive, that's what they did in every story. And how do you do that when you're stuck in school in San Francisco?
Yeah, I think that would be a totally different and unusual dynamic for that. You know, and they'd probably have lots of different away trips and things like that. But, yeah, I don't know. I don't know if that would be super, if I would find that super compelling, to tell you the truth. Like the, you know,
yeah, I don't
to examine that. I almost don't want to see.
Going with the arc thing, how do you have an arc in that situation?
Well,
is a way to do it. There is a way to do it, because if you do it the right way, you set it up with them having a bunch of field trips or just the characters just getting into a lot of trouble and going on unauthorized field trips and getting themselves into trouble, which would bring in a younger audience to get them interested into Star Trek.
True, and while I do like the idea of, like, a university starship that travels around, so that, you know, like, a traveler's scholarship, the problem is, in this time period in Star Trek, it takes a long time to travel from place to place, as established in both the original series and Enterprise. It takes weeks to travel between stars. You wouldn't be able to get to that field trip location and back on an unauthorized, you know, field trip without being expelled from school because you're away from school for multiple weeks.
That's true.
Yeah. Well, I think they'd probably get a, you know, work around that somehow. You know, you could have plenty of adventures nearby and such.
True.
It's really
and
compelling.
A lot of people are arguing whether it's in the Prime universe or in the one set up by the movies, because if it's in the one set up by the movies, they have transwarp transporters, so they can instantly teleport to whatever planet they want to have their shenanigans on.
Oof. Yeah, that bothered me.
Yeah.
That bothered me. That just kind of made things irrelevant. You know, J.J. Abrams has taken that concept from, you know, science fiction into the realm of science fantasy, which bothered me to some degree. You know, Star Trek should never rely on blowing something up as the conclusion. The best Star Trek never has.
Well, and the problem with the new what's the most recent one called Into Darkness.
Yeah.
If they actually looked at it from the bad guy's perspective, if he truly believed a war with the Klingons was coming, he would want to build more of those super warships before that happened, because that's his advantage. When you have that ability to build those, time is now on your side. So if he had just waited, the whole story wouldn't have been needed, and he would have known that because he was a general.
Yeah. I'm hoping the next one is more about the wonders of exploration and things like that. You know, what bothered me about that was the fact that the last 25 minutes of the movie were really just a giant chase scene, you know, and it just bothered the hell out of me. That it was taken to that regard, because it's supposed to be a retelling of Wrath of Khan, basically, you know.
Yeah.
And then the end of Wrath of Khan did not have a 20-minute chase scene, and then a giant, horrible disaster, you know, of a spaceship crashing into half of San Francisco. You know, that was that was crazy. But anyway,
there was no space battle. Like in the first one, there was multiple space battles. In that one, the only space battle that was there was the Enterprise just getting trashed in a one-sided firefight.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know how that... Yeah, I wasn't a huge fan of them. Like, a bunch of other people left that movie and were really taken by it and loved it. And I was like, that's nothing real. But, you know, being an author, you sort of... You're much more critical of stuff like that. And you don't buy it as much.
Mm-hmm.
So, Tempest, if we were to take the analysis of another series, and maybe either through the entire series or maybe just one of the books, but where do you think the crescendo of the Harry Potter series lives? That's a big question, I know.
That is a big question, because there are just so many points where he's at that point where he really needs to figure things out. I mean, just from the first book he really needs to figure out, is he really the person that everyone already thinks he is? Everyone looks at him as a savior, and he's just like, I have no idea what the hell I'm doing. So he needs to figure out, wait, am I actually the person who did all of this? How did I do all of this? And am I really worthy of the attention? And it's kind of, you know, as the years go on, he becomes more confident in that. So that's like the first. So, but
yeah,
there's so many.
There's many a one. My kids read those or watch those movies constantly and read those books like back to front. So they're really into that. So let's try another one.
I actually think there's a lot that because there's not that very many points in those stories where things are out of control, where the rest of the story is not within the main character's choice pattern. Because I think that's when once the main character has either made a choice that now is set in stone or something happens that's beyond their control, like a disaster, I think that's a crescendo moment. And there's a lot of points where either the main characters or their buddies can step in and change things. So I think there's actually fewer in the Harry Potter series than you'd actually expect.
Right. You know, I would say probably the moment that strikes me as the most critical for Harry is when Dumbledore dies. Spoiler alert.
Yeah, I would agree.
Absolutely.
You know, yeah, because that's
really...
Death is out
of your control.
Yeah, because that's like the point where, you know, maybe he could have decided to like to run and hide somewhere, but he didn't. But yeah, that story is a grand. I don't know how many thousands of pages worth of story arc in crescendo and hero's journey for good old Harry Potter. Harry Potter and Friends. I'm looking forward to that new movie that's coming out, starring Eddie Redmayne, about the Fantastic Beasts and where to find them. That looks actually really cool. So that's
is it
be,
part of a series, or is it or is it standalone?
I think it's a standalone. I think it's a standalone.
Well, J.K. Rowling had actually released essentially textbooks from the school a couple of years back, and now she's doing Fantastic Beasts was actually one of the textbooks that she released a few years back. So it's based on the person who wrote the textbook.
Oh, cool.
They
keep referencing it, which is cool. I like those text within text type things.
I hope they get a good writer. Do you know if Rowling is actually writing the script for that, or are they bringing in a writer for it?
She's writing.
She's writing the script, really?
She said she was writing the script for Fantastic Beasts.
Cool. Very cool. You know, I was so
pleased
that they
didn't...
probably
going to turn it into a series. I can't see her writing.
Yeah, it could be.
She's a little long-winded. I can't see her writing something in just one book and letting it be.
Let me ask you guys about the seventh... Go ahead.
I think it's going to be more than one movie. I think it might be two. I'm not sure, though.
I really think it's, great to revisit a universe like that because it's so rich and well put together that it's a shame not to, you know. It's a shame not to. I think I'm really looking forward to Star Wars coming out in under 40 days now, which is it's going to be amazing.
Oh, that's either going to be really good or really bad.
Yeah.
That's the
I can't... I it's going to be definitely a pull-up from the prequels.
Well, they could have 10 hours of just someone dancing in a circle, and it would... Nah, I'm too critical.
No, you have a point, because dancing in a circle... You know, if it was like... Greedo dancing in a circle, that would be pretty cool. But like maybe the slave girl dancing in a circle in Jabba's palace, like just for an hour. At least she can dance. But the concept of the prequels was truly somebody who went overboard and indulged themselves and had literally no one giving him any kind of feedback or questioning any of his decisions. That's like
yeah, there was clearly many points where even if someone he was even taking slight advice from someone, they would have said, George, maybe not.
Yeah. What struck me about that film, the first, well, let's look at The Phantom Menace just because it's really fun to make fun of. But The Phantom Menace, to me, really, and some people say, well, it's a children's movie. It's for kids, you know? People felt the same way about Star Wars. I'm like, wait a minute. Star Wars may be for children, but it was never childish. And
yeah.
That's why I think is the grand differentiator. If you look at the characters, like the sort of parallels, the parallel to Jar Jar Binks is Chewbacca. He's like that sort of like, you know, alien guy character, quasi-comic relief character. And in Star Wars, he was so cool and rich.
And he was given Jar Jar Binks. Part of it was because he was mute. You can say a lot without saying anything. And sometimes it's better not to say anything. Jar Jar is a perfect example of when it's better not to say anything.
Yeah, it's funny. It's so funny. You know, it is whenever we talk about this stuff on the show, and we always dive into Star Wars. And I think one of the reasons is that it adheres in its best moments to the you know, to the rules of storytelling, the hero's journey, the climax, the resolution.
Well, I don't know.
When
in a well-written story, every character is supposed to have an arc. What's Jar Jar's arc?
He stumbles into dissolving
dumb
Parliament,
luck.
I think.
Yeah. His arc is nothing but luck.
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I interrupted you. What were you going to say?
I don't know.
You're right about that.
I was going to make fun of probably George Lucas for a bit, but I guess Star Wars is such a great way to explore these things. It's so universal. You know, we can just talk about the climax of those films and everybody understands it. You know, or we could talk about like you know some random French impressionist novel that no one gets. But it's cool. I'm psyched for the new films, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too. Well, I agree with you is that it's a good thing to look at is because you have one example of doing it very well and one example of doing it very badly in the same universe.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, I'm looking forward to the physicality of the film. It looks like it's going to be a very physical film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the CGI looks like it's been banished for the most part. I'm sure it's used, you know, in practically every scene. But the physical sets look fantastic, so I'm really psyched about it.
Well, there's a difference between using the CGI to support what you're doing on screen and using the CGI on screen. It's supposed to be a support tool, not the entire tool.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So I recall like a quote about comparing the usage of special effects, and it was a quote relating to Citizen Kane and versus the prequels, and it was like the prequels Citizen Kane used special effects to tell a story. George Lucas used a story to tell special effects.
Yeah. Well, what you were saying earlier about when Obi-Wan Kenobi was killed as being the crescendo of the first Star Wars movie, I actually agree because the way I look at crescendos is you're setting up all of your dominoes beforehand. You're putting your plot points in your place. You're establishing character traits. You know, you're doing your writer's thing and building the world and people and activities and such like that. The crescendo is when you push over that first domino, and then everything is out of the character's hand because it's all already in motion. And once Obi-Wan dies, The Empire knows where to go because they're tracking the Millennium Falcon, and everything is inexorably going to be pushed towards the final showdown.
Right, it's gone ballistic.
Yes.
It's gone into a state where whatever, something's going to happen. There's going to be blood on the floor. You know,
well, there's always two. There's always the domino moment where you push it, and then there's the touchdown moment, which is where you want to, you know, spike the football and celebrate. And
yeah.
You need both.
Exactly. So Obi-Wan died, and then the Death Star exploded. So that was sort of the ultimate resolution is, you know, everyone gives them medals. Chewbacca didn't get a medal. That makes me so mad.
Yeah, but, it's Wookiee racism. Even the rebels are racist against Wookiees.
Wookiee racism. And he makes that, like, at the end, and everyone, like, points and laughs. Like, Chewbacca, it's great. His people are so musical.
He was complaining.
Where's my medal? Yep. Yeah. Yeah, crazy town.
Even the droids got medals.
Did they?
I thought they did.
I remember the droids. No, I don't think they got medals. I think it was just Han and Luke that got medals.
Okay.
I think Chewbacca would have kicked over R2-D2 if he got a medal. That would have been
really
bad.
Well, they can just
really
put R2-D2 back together. That's the advantage of being a droid.
Yeah, but I think, you know, like, he would have done it during the ceremony. Would have kicked them over. It would have been an entirely cooler, much better way to end that movie.
An act of petty revenge.
Like, everyone just standing around like, oh crap, what happened? The Wookiee just ran. All right, the end. So Star Wars is easy to tell these metaphors through, and it kind of goes back. Cause, you know, I don't know every book you guys have read, but I know everyone has seen Star Wars. And I thought everyone had seen Wrath of Khan.
Yeah, I'm surprised you haven't. I mean, that's like on basic writer requirements.
Yeah.
My older brother is the Trekkie, and he lived with his mom growing up, and I lived with mine. And, you know, that was pretty much that. There wasn't a lot of Star Trek playing in my house while I was growing up.
Oh, man. Well, those things happen. It's okay. You can always... It's
you should
never
put it on
late.
Your to-read list.
Yeah, or to-watch list. It's got some really great moments where people... Where he yells Khan as loud as he can, when Kirk yells Khan. And Ricardo Montalban is just, like, on fire in that movie.
Oh, listen to
it. And it's a movie that demands overacting, so Shatner's perfect for the role, finally, in that movie, because everything is a very dramatic situation. It's like the writers finally realized, oh, we're writing for Shatner. Okay, so we can't change the way Shatner acts, so let's write for Shatner.
Dun-da-da. That's perfect. Absolutely perfect. Everything is its own sentence. Awesome.
Every word needs a period after it.
Yep. Good old William Shatner. He's like, he's one of those things, even if you're not a Trekkie, I think it's important to understand him from a cultural perspective. You have to understand him, you know, just to get, I mean, everyone is now sort of in love with George Takei because of, you know, just his one-man attack on social media and meme creation. But, you know, Shatner in his own way is just fascinating. In a way that's just bizarre. Have you guys ever seen a film called The Room?
Ever
heard of it? The Room.
I've heard of it.
Is a film by this guy named Tommy Wiseau, and it is like the best worst movie ever. It is the most bizarre, strange film that you'll ever see. It's one of those you know movies that they play, you know, at midnight at the local, you know, independent movie theater, and everyone just goes and watches. It's crazy. It's crazy bad. It's so bad. And that's like one of those other cultural things that I think writers should know about. So, as far as arcs are concerned, and I tend to drop to movies to talk about this stuff, and my bad, because it's, you know, it's kind of hard to know exactly what everyone's read. But as far as arcs,
well, everyone's read Lord of the Rings. We can use Lord of the Rings, can't we?
Yeah, well, we can talk about the movie version. Sure.
I haven't read the Lord of the Rings or watched
the
movies.
Fortunately, the movie version is just an abridged version of the books.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it. They didn't change
any plot points.
Right. That's why I called him Mr. Frodo the whole time. Mr. Frodo! You know, like he was a valet.
Well, he kind of was. He was the Hobbit equivalent of a valet. He was Gardner.
Yeah. Yeah. Come with me, Gardner. Must have been like kind of an awkward conversation, like halfway into it. We're like, you know, I think he just asked me to come along. And I didn't know I was going to be eaten by a giant spider or whatever the heck happened to him. But, yeah, so I guess that the journey for them is really whether or not to be seduced by the well, you know what, you know the Lord of the Rings better than us. Have at it, Joshua. What's the hero's journey for Lord of the Rings?
Well, I think one of the reasons why Lord of the Rings is one of the best pieces of literature ever created is because every single character has a complete character arc, even the characters that don't deserve them. And so you look at people like, you know, like the journey of the elves leaving the world, and the fact that several of them do choose a point at which to stand with the humans, knowing they would die. And the thing is, it's not a trite story like in a lot of modern literature, where, oh, they made the right choice, so they're, you know, most of them are going to survive. No, when the elves decide to stay, they die. They're slaughtered.
Yeah.
It is a final decision. And I think that's what is missing in a lot of modern literature, is the fact that final decisions are cheapened by this expectation that we have that somehow all the main characters will survive. And that's why George Martin has had such incredible popularity, because he returned to the things that Tolkien and Shakespeare and a lot of the great writers did, is the characters' arcs actually concluded. And they ended, and they ended well. A lot of them ended in death. So it's like with Frodo, his character, his crescendo came very early in the story. The thing that set the dominoes in motion is when he left Rivendell with the ring, when he stood up, because at that point,
right,
there, it was basically all out of his control, because everybody else was guiding him through it. Even when he went out onto his own, he was still being guided and pushed and shoved through the story by Sam. And that's why,
yeah,
Sam, a lot of times people think he's a more interesting character, because he's the one that's more actively making the choices in the story and pushing Frodo through it, because Frodo enters this, you know, zombie-like fugue state halfway through the story, where he's just focusing on not taking the ring, not putting it on, and, you know, giving himself up, basically.
Yeah, Sam's like the people... he's the heart. Sam's the heart of that book.
Yeah,
he's
in a
the
way,
guy that...
but you also have Aragorn, which is the more obvious. You know, that's the reason it's so good, is because you have different story arcs, some for the people that are just on the surface level, who only see things like Aragorn and Frodo, and then you have the deeper ones, like people who are watching Arwen's story or Sam's story. And so it has everything for different intellectual tiers.
So, Tempest, what's your, slightly off topic, but what is your favorite all-time book besides mine? I assume you're just going to yell Timberwolf. But, you know, besides that one, what's your favorite book? Do you have a book that you go back to every year and reread it or look at it?
Oh, I have a lot of books. Right now, I'm probably Rochelle Mead's Age of X series. has me really interested. I have the first two books. I'm waiting for the third one. It really,
cool.
It's just really interesting.
What? Tell us about that book, and tell us what it is about that's got you.
Well, essentially, the country, it's become illegal to essentially practice religion, but there are small religious groups that get permission from the government to practice, but they're monitored by the government in case there's any real proof of, say, a deity that's involved.
So what about people who actually believe but refuse to get government approval? Is there black market people who have religion?
Absolutely, and they actually can be arrested for it. But the thing is that one of the people who audits the religious sects actually turns out to hear voices in his own head. It turns out to be a deity. And one of the soldiers who is assigned to protect him has another deity in her head, and they're both anti-religion, and it's their journey choosing whether or not to believe that they're actually hearing these gods, giving them directions and what they need to to kind of fix the country.
That's amazing.
Either of you read the Stormlight Archive by Brandon Sanderson?
No, I haven't.
No.
Oh, you want to talk about beautiful story arcs that are just exquisitely crafted. You should read the Stormlight Archive by Brandon Sanderson.
Yeah.
The best two books of the modern age. He
really?
I've never seen something so perfectly set up and executed as the main character from the Stormlight Archive. Even the side characters, just every point of view character, he obviously sat down and spent hundreds of hours developing all of their motivations, developing everything he would need to set up his dominoes in the exact perfect arrangement so that when everything goes down, it fits together in a perfect story. And the final battles starts out very small, but it shows the logical progression of how, you know, a small little thing like an assassination attempt turns into this massive conflagration of an apocalyptic level. And it's just really good.
It sounds like World War One.
I know, right? World War One is the perfect example of crescendo and unavoidable.
Oh,
outcome.
That's awesome. All right. Let's go into, you know, forget books for a second. Let's go into events. The crescendo of history. You know, if we look Archduke Ferdinand. I had ideas I had pitched to Star Trek was a time travel story called The Princip Theory about stopping the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand. And my take on it was that even if they didn't, you know, like it was kind of this cool story where they the Deep Space Nine crew like stopped the assassination. There was some kind of, you know, moral reason why they were doing it. And then like literally they turn around and like 2 minutes later somebody else kills him, and the same stuff happens.
kind of like that's just like it, where they make the wrong turn and end up right back at the assassin.
Yeah, so like they like Sisko had stopped the assassin, and he's like, "What have I done? I've possibly ruined history." Blah. And then like, you know, a second later, like somebody throws a bomb and kills the Archduke anyway. So it was sort of like showing that, you know, regardless of what you did, it was all moving towards that thing. It was sort of like if I wanted to turn Star Trek into like, you know, a Russian novel, that would have been it. Your life means nothing. So they didn't like that one.
It sounds like Tolstoy. It certainly sounds like Tolstoy.
Yeah, they didn't buy that one. They, you know, but I always love that. I love that idea. I might, You know, if I ever get a chance to tell a time travel story, that's the one I want to tell.
Of the immutable stream way of viewing time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where you can change small things, but it's elastic and always goes back to the way it should be.
I think so. I think that, you know, the waves, I think things are inevitable, like the forces that are making something happen, you know, are not necessarily domino, like single dominoes, but maybe like, you know, a row of 50 dominoes that are coming at you,
mm-hmm.
and other things could you know, allow grand events to happen.
Yeah.
So,
well, I think it
like
also depends on your religious views, because if you have religious views of any sort, that's going to affect your view of how time would play out.
It's like the Greek fates. It's like the Greek fates. When you're born, you know, everything is already planned out. So you can make choices, but your destiny, according to them, is already planned. When you're going to die, what's going to happen to you? So it's like you can try to change certain things, but the question is, can you really change destiny? So in cases like that, if you time travel, it's like, can you really escape a destiny?
Well, if you can't escape it, then even is it destiny? I mean, that's the real question.
That's another philosophical question there.
I actually am working on a fantasy story. I'm actually working on a fantasy story where the villain is a demon who's taken on the persona of fate, of destiny. And her grand lie is that destiny exists, that you can't escape fate, quite literally. And so it is a battle of fate that goes on in the story.
Huh. Oh, that's cool.
That
so she's telling people that she's telling people there's no way to change your fate, but actually that's BS, and you really do have. You're in charge of your own destiny.
Yeah,
but she's using. I mean, that's wonderful.
Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, that's wonderful because it sort of you know, goes back to the concept of the devil being like the, you know, just the purveyor of lies.
Yeah, the prince of lies.
Prince of lies. Did I say purveyor? It's like he runs a stand.
Yes. That was like Mephistopheles. Mephistopheles is his middle manager who's running the carnival stand
the
of
banana
lies.
Stand.
The devil's the prince of lies, but Mephistopheles he's just the purveyor of lies. You can buy whatever lie you want there.
There you go.
Lies for sale.
I use the wrong words sometimes, and it's hilarious.
Well, I do too. I think every writer does. That's why we have a delete button.
Yeah.
I like them to get out there once in a while, because then we have silly conversations, just like what we just did. You know, some other people like wouldn't have caught that or would have not understood where we're coming from. But I like the idea of talking to writers and getting my right on. It's good stuff. It's good stuff to talk to you guys.
It gets even funnier when you add alcohol to the mix.
Yeah. I was drinking tonight was a Kronenbourg Blanc, which is a fine French beer. But
I can't drink beer anymore.
Sorry to hear it.
Yeah, I have a gluten allergy. Pretty much all of everything I can't drink anymore.
Oh, no. I order things with extra gluten to make up for you guys, because it's hard to hear all that. Give me the gluten. Give me all the gluten. So we are approaching our 8 o'clock hour, our 1 hour allotted Radio Z time has come and gone once again. We've got 7 minutes left to have some final thoughts, but we've had some really nice, interesting conversation about the idea of climax and story arcs and how to take characters through the journey and different journeys they found. I want to challenge you guys to a couple more tell me the arcs in the story. So, Tempest, can you tell me the crescendo in Back to the Future?
Oh, God, I haven't seen that since I was like 8.
You didn't watch it recently?
Come on.
Because it was Back to the Future Day?
I was really busy. I actually had a deadline last week. So I didn't get a chance to.
Oh, no. How about The Princess Bride? Got that one?
I never saw The Princess Bride, but I've seen the Back to the Future movies.
Oh,
God.
We have not seeing The Princess Bride is something we have to talk about, you know, on the side. But Back to the Future, you know. All right, Joshua, what's the crescendo of Back to the Future?
Back to the Future, first one, I would definitely say,
yep.
It's when the vehicle breaks and they don't have a way back.
I remember
there
that.
There you go. That was it.
Although the first one was clearly when the Libyans showed up and, you know, did their thing.
The Libyans. The Libyans have made them a nuclear device out of pinball parts.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. I want to see Bernie Sanders do a Doc Brown imitation.
Oh, my goodness. That would be
someday. That would be so great. That would be so great. These billionaires and billionaires have 7-8 time machines. I have one. One time machine. But anyway,
I was wondering
guys,
how they can get
just,
their investments right. Now you know.
Yeah. My time machine is not too big to fail. So.
Wow.
Yeah. So we've had a great time tonight, and we are approaching our witching hour of 8 o'clock. And I just wanted to thank Joshua and Tempest for joining me tonight. And Joshua, your book is the Exile Empire series. And
yep.
Thank you so much for joining us. And Tempest, thank you for joining us. Your book is the Mystic Academy series. And
yep.
I look forward to reading both of those in the near future. And this is your host, Tom Julian, author of Timberwolf, signing off on the Radio Z Hour. If you'd like to join us on Facebook, you can join us at fb.com/tzppradioz. And check out the first chapters of Zarmé books at firstreadsfirst.com. That's first, reads with a Z, first.com. All right, everybody, thank you very much, and have a great week. Take care.
Bye.
Have a good one.
Nice.
Bye.
Bye.